have walked off their jobs to demand higher pay and to be able to cope with soaring inflation and worsening cost of living crisis. February has already seen more than 500,000 people take industrial action in the country. With public strike fatigue nowhere in sight, the walkouts are likely to continue for months. In reaction to the dispute, the government is set to unveil strike legislation in the near future to contain industrial actions in its key sectors, forcing the staff to maintain a basic level of services during the strike time for face dismissal. According to Guardian, this week's action comes almost 4 weeks after the NEU staged its first day of a strike action, which closed thousands of schools across the country, some partially, others entirely. The Department for Education said 9.3% of state schools in England were entirely closed by the industrial action and 44.7% were left partially open, with restricted attendance. Fewer than one in five secondary schools, 17.4%, were fully open compared with just 52.1% of primary schools. Last week, the government offered to move to formal talks on pay if the union agreed to suspend its planned strike action. The union rejected the offer, saying it would only pause the strike if there was significant progress. Gillian Keegan, the education secretary, said the government had made a serious offer to the leaders of both the NEU and Royal College of Nursing to pause the strikes in return for talks about pay, conditions and reform.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A year has passed since the ongoing war in Ukraine broke out. Prospects for an end to the war look bleak. Instead of supporting dialogue and a peaceful resolution, the West, particularly the US, have fanned the flames of war by sending billions of dollars in arms to Ukraine. This trend has only further escalated the conflict. Last week, Beijing called for a comprehensive ceasefire as it released a peace plan to end the war in Ukraine. The document, which covers 12 aspects, adheres to the principle of respecting the sovereignty of both countries. It calls for resuming peace talks and promotes the post-conflict reconstruction in the long run. Beijing also demanded an end to unilateral sanctions on Russia and criticized NATO expansion, saying the US and NATO are fanning the flames and adding fuel to the fire, and they are the culprit and pusher of the crisis. China also made clear its opposition to not only the use of nuclear weapons, but the threat of deploying them, saying nuclear weapons must not be used and nuclear wars must not be fought. In addition, China also called for efforts to set up humanitarian corridors for the evacuation of civilians from conflict zones, to protect civilians and prisoners of war, and to facilitate grain exports. China has sought to position itself as a neutral party in the conflict and play the role of a mediator. Meanwhile, Russia said it has paid a lot of attention to the plan by China, but the conditions for a peaceful resolution of the conflict were not in place. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said, "For now, we don't see any of the conditions that are needed to bring this whole story towards peace." Moscow had said that any settlement of the conflict needed to recognize Russia's control over four Ukrainian regions it annexed last year. It also wants Ukraine to renounce its bid to join NATO. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said his country needed to work with China, arguing it seems that there is a respect for Ukraine's territorial integrity and security issues in the Chinese perspective. However, Kyiv said that it will not agree to any peace without the return of all its territory. The publication of the proposal follows accusations from the West that China is considering arming Russia, a claim Beijing has dismissed as false information. Ukraine's head of military intelligence has brushed aside claims that China is considering sending arms to Russia. Kirill Budanov told U.S. media that he saw no signs that such things are even being discussed. That's after senior U.S. officials said that they were confident China was considering providing lethal equipment to Moscow. Earlier this month, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken aired Washington's concerns about potential arms shipments in a tense meeting with his Chinese counterpart. Also, the director of the CIA, William Burns, said in an interview on Sunday that he believed Beijing was still weighing the possibility. Asked specifically about the U.S. assessment, Budanov said, "I am the head of intelligence and I rely with all due respect not on the opinions of individual people but only on facts. I do not see such facts." China says it has kept contact with all sides in the crisis, including Kyiv, and its position was clear. The core is to call for peace and promote dialogue and promote a political solution to the crisis. China has warned that the war in Ukraine is getting out of control. Beijing has urged certain countries to stop adding fuel to the fire, saying it's deeply concerned about the situation. Beijing rejected the U.S. and NATO claims as false and said it is the U.S. that is endlessly sending arms to Ukraine, not China. The U.S. and NATO have been warning China against sending weapons to Russia, while they have been providing Ukraine with billions of dollars in arms and military aid since the beginning of the war a year ago.
The U.S. desire to dominate the world by poking its nose into other countries' affairs, especially when things are not in its favor, is not hidden anymore. In the latest example, Russia has come out accusing Washington of attempting to disrupt its relations with nations on the African continent. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov said the United States and its allies are conducting an unprecedented campaign for Russia's political and economic isolation, including the disruption of the second Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg scheduled for July. Bogdanov said Western countries embarked on their collective campaign to isolate Russia in the international arena ever since the beginning of this special military operation in Ukraine. He noted that the West, in order to achieve its anti-Russia agenda, has significantly piled up pressure on African countries through threats of imposing sanctions, termination of financial and humanitarian aid. Bogdanov's assessment came more than a month after Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited South Africa as part of his African tour. During Lavrov's visit to Pretoria, which was the second since last year, the two sides pledged to boost bilateral ties. In a joint presser, top South African diplomat Naledi Pandor even lauded the growing economic partnership between the two countries, along with political, economic, social, defense, and security cooperation. Lavrov's successful visit to the continent and planned Russia-Africa summit and economic forum in July are testimonies that West, the U.S. in particular, have failed in their plots to isolate Russia internationally. A visit by the Russian diplomat to South Africa refurbished the common pursuit of the two countries for upholding world peace and security and promoting global development and prosperity. With South Africa hosting the Summit of Five Emerging Economies, commonly known as BRICS, this year, the ruling African National Congress has suggested that Pretoria could use the chairmanship to push for the admission of new members to expand the bloc and challenge the global arrogance. In the words of Pender herself, the current global geopolitical tensions clearly signal the need to create institutional mechanisms that will have the stature from the global trust to promote and support global peace and security. BRICS should play a proactive role in emerging processes and ensure it is part of a redesigned global order. Recent joint naval drills involving South Africa, Russia, and China, despite U.S. criticism, show these countries' resolve to stand against the global dominance of some powers. Pender argued that hosting such maneuvers with what she called friends were part of the natural course of relations. Nevertheless, the popular resentment against the West, the U.S., the U.K., and France in particular, are on the rise due to their historic oppression on the continent. Anti-West sentiment could be clearly seen in nationwide protests in Burkina Faso, with demonstrators condemning former colonizer France while waving Russian flags. Growing dissatisfaction with France is largely visible in other former colonies across Africa, including Mali. At this moment, the unity is an anti-colonial power structure seem to be of high urgency for African nations. A change from unipolar to multipolar arrangement is another need, especially for East African countries that are embroiled in power politics. These could uplift not only the continental stature, but a unified power to reckon with. However, this major paradigm shift can be duly achievable if countries across the African continent come together and stand firm against the West's imperialism. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has announced the operation of a new cruise missile with a range of over 1,600 kilometers. Speaking at a televised program, commander of the IRGC Aerospace Division, Brigadier General Amirali Hajizadeh, said the new long-range missile is codenamed Pave. The commander said this was to honor the Iranian forces martyred in the Kurdistan province. The Brigadier General noted that all of Iran's missiles are now manufactured with precision-guided accuracy, adding that all American bases in the region are within the reach of the Iranian missiles. Hajizadeh said, "We are now capable of targeting American aircraft carriers at a 2,000-kilometer distance." He noted that the U.S.'s superiority has been shaking after Iran developed its new hypersonic missile, which can maneuver outside the Earth's atmosphere and defeat all anti-missile defense systems. In a stern warning also to Europe, the Iranian commander said, "Of course, we have kept a distance at 2,000 kilometers out of respect for the Europeans," adding, "We hope that Europeans would preserve their dignity." The remarks by the Iranian commander came at a time when Europe has done its share of trying to antagonize Iran by closely aligning its Tehran policies with those of the U.S. After all, the European countries, namely France, Germany, and the UK, have been maintaining a hostile posture toward Iran's defensive missile and peaceful nuclear programs. The EU has also challenged Tehran's regional influence and cooperated with Washington in its anti-Iran sanctions. Needless to say that last month, the European Parliament approved an amendment calling on the European Union and its member states to include the IRGC on their terror list. The resolution drew strong reaction from Iran. IRGC's chief commander, Major General Hossein Salami, warned that the Europeans would suffer the consequences of the move. The 27-nation bloc has also been slapping more sanctions on Iran over what it calls the country's approach toward foreign-backed riots that erupted in some Iranian cities in September. The recent IRGC announcement comes as the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called on the country's military to increase its efforts to attract, nurture, and train capable Iranians in line with the Islamic Revolution military doctrine. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has called on the IRGC to use its full capabilities to be able to protect the revolution and to strengthen the IRGC's spiritual and military foundations. This can be clearly highlighted in General Hajizadeh's comments when he addressed the issue of Iran's growing missile power. He has enumerated features of the country's hypersonic missile that was manufactured late last year and announced a new cruise missile's inclusion in the list of IRGC's military hardware. This brings to the spotlight the military might of the Islamic Republic, which includes capabilities of Iran's army with its latest underground base for fighter jets and more particularly the country's missile power in the face of the West's threats. That comprises threats coming from Israel, with the regime targeting several military sites in the city of Isfahan lately. While U.S.'s benefit lies in creating regional insecurity, as General Hajizadeh put it, there needs to be a military power in the region to deter such threats. Tehran believes that Washington is a root cause of almost all global conflicts, including the war in Ukraine. The Islamic Republic argues that the West Asia region sits on a security fault line, given the history of conflicts in the past four decades. Another factor that Tehran has always highlighted is the need to maintain the country's military might. It says if it fails to be strong, the enemy will bring the war inside Iran. That's why Iranian military commanders urge and advise Iranian armed forces to meet the security needs of the nation. Given all the threats posed by the U.S. and its allies, the Corps has always been aiming to render the American war machine ineffective and thus has managed to bring all the U.S.'s regional bases within the range of its defensive firepower. They have also turned Washington bases in the region into its weak spots, with the IRGC having the ability to strike U.S. outposts whenever the need arises.
Another missile test by North Korea. Four long-range cruise missiles. This particular test, however, was different. Even North Korea's media reported it that way. Strategic cruise missiles designed to demonstrate its ability to conduct a nuclear counterattack. The key word, counterattack. North Korea has been very clear about its missile tests, and there's nothing new there. It has been in response to the U.S. joint war games in the region, whether with South Korea or Japan. However, now it has described the weapons as strategic, suggesting that they are being developed with the intent to arm them with nuclear warheads. The scenario of North Korea's missile launches and the types of ballistic missiles came into full gear in the year 2022, during the U.S. presidency of Joe Biden. North Korea fired more than 70 ballistic missiles, the most ever. But why would these launches increase so much during Joe Biden's tenure? One reason: the U.S. lack of a foreign policy approach towards North Korea. Just war games and condemnations. The U.S. has even flown B-52 bombers in its war games. High-ranking U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham once said, quote, "If there's going to be a war to stop Kim Jong-un, it will be over there. If thousands die, they're going to die over there." Sanctions have been exhausted. Yet what has been missing is diplomacy or some kind of peace process. But the U.S. has no appetite for that. The U.S. track record shows that it chooses military solutions to foreign policy problems. But why, when in the case of North Korea, given that it has intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of reaching the U.S. mainland? In the past, the U.S. has used the preventive approach. The U.S. has in its attack doctrine preventive strikes, which differ from preemptive strikes in that they would not be a response to imminent attack from an enemy. Preventive military action has become a popular option among U.S. officials, culminating with George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq. But there's a more important reason. The U.S. may simply use this approach towards North Korea in order to make it give concessions. That, along with the U.S.'s long-sought prize, China. The U.S.'s coming war with China is now perceived as not a matter of if, but when. The telltale signs are there. From the U.S. national security reports, which cite China as the number one threat to U.S. national security, to arming allies in the region, like Japan, the Philippines, and Taiwan. For example, Tokyo just recently announced a record 26.3% increase in its defense spending, which will include missiles capable of reaching China. And then there's Taiwan, which aside from arming it to the tune of billions of dollars, the U.S. will be sending more troops to the island. The U.S. proxy war in Ukraine, possible showdown with Russia, its military threats against Iran, and its potential conflict with North Korea and China. Open Society Foundations described it best when it said, America is in a constant state of war, and its founding values are approaching annihilation.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Since the start of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the United States and its European allies have imposed an array of unprecedented sanctions against Russia and poured numerous advanced weaponry into Ukraine, despite repeated warnings by Kremlin that such measures will only prolong the war. Russian officials have also charged the United States of being prepared to sacrifice Ukraine and the developing world in order to beat Russia and maintain its global hegemony. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Site of Fact Checked has covered this story and tells us more. According to a report, the United States has sent more military assistance to help Ukraine fight Russia than Washington spent annually to fight its own war in Afghanistan. The data compiled by the German research firm Statista showed that the U.S. military aid to Ukraine up to mid-January, covering the first 11 months of the conflict, totaled $46.6 billion. Citing data from the Kiel Institute for the World Economy, Statista said that compared with an average annual military spending of $43.4 billion during the first 10 years of the war in Afghanistan. Statista data journalist Martin Armstrong said, when calculating the average annual costs of previous wars in which the United States has been involved in, the true magnitude of the country's Ukraine aid expenditure can be seen. Martin Armstrong added, the Ukraine total doesn't include an additional $5 billion worth of weapons and equipment that the Pentagon sent to Kiev. The figures, however, exclude non-military aid, such as the $4.5 billion that U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to fund pensions, government salary, and another public spending. In total, the United States has allocated $113 billion in Ukraine aid, and multiple administration officials have vowed to keep supporting Kiev as long as it takes. Americans have sent more money to Ukraine than Russia spends on its annual military budget. Russia spends about $65 to $70 billion a year. The U.S. sent more than $100 billion, including non-military aid, and plus there are the other NATO countries and those in Asia who also support Ukraine. A number of U.S. lawmakers, such as Representatives Seth Moulton of Massachusetts and Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, have called the Ukraine conflict a proxy war that the United States and NATO are waging against Russia. Marjorie Taylor Greene called the war in Ukraine a deadly, profitable industry and demanded the US withdrawal from NATO military alliance. While referring to the Biden administration's massive military aid to Ukraine as a proxy war against Russia that Americans have no appetite for, Marjorie Taylor Greene said, "The American people do not want war with Russia, but NATO and our own foolish leaders are dragging us into one. We should pull out of NATO." In a series of tweets in which she has expressed fierce criticism of Washington's response to the Ukraine conflict by sending billions of taxpayer dollars to the country and risking a potential nuclear war, Marjorie Taylor Greene further added that Ukraine is now the new Iraq, wrapped up with a pretty little NATO bow with a nuclear present inside. CNN has also covered this story and tells us more. A senior U.S. official has said the United States is preparing a fresh military aid package to Ukraine worth $2 billion, defying repeated warnings from Moscow as the war completes 1 year. U.S. President Joe Biden's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan made the disclosure recently, asserting that Washington is ready to support Kiev for the long haul. While announcing new aid, Jake Sullivan said, "We're going to continue to look at what is necessary and make sure that we provide what is necessary, that Ukraine has what it needs to succeed on the battlefield." U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, who accompanied Joe Biden on an unannounced trip to Kiev recently, said U.S. officials are constantly looking to give Volodymyr Zelensky's administration the tools that it needs to win against Russia. He did not reveal details of the new military aid package, but Western media reports said it builds on previous packages of aid to Kiev. CNN reports said the $2 billion package includes new funding for contracts including HIMARS rockets, 155mm artillery munition, drones, counter-drone equipment, mine-clearing equipment, and secure communications equipment. Jake Sullivan said the U.S. has provided Kiev with assistance it needs for each phase of the war, but acknowledged that the Ukrainians have often asked for more than the United States is willing to give them. The top U.S. security official, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, reiterated the Biden administration's position that it's not currently providing F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine, much to the chagrin of Ukrainian officials. Meanwhile, Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz said, "Whether or not to arm Ukraine with drones doesn't make any sense at the moment." Olaf Scholz, who has previously faced criticism for pulling back on sending tanks to Ukraine, said difficulties faced by other countries in meeting Ukraine's military demands vindicated his decision to move to lock them down. Earlier this month, Germany agreed to send heavy battle tanks to help Ukraine attack Russian forces in the east of the country, allowing other countries to send them. However, the delivery has so far been slow due to limited donor resources. Russia Today, the RT network, has also covered this story and tells us more. A former U.S. state senator says the United States is to blame for constantly meddling in the internal affairs of independent countries and starting both wars in Iraq and Ukraine. Former state senator from Virginia, Richard Black, said the U.S. overthrew the governments of both of these countries to turn them into puppets, stressing that Washington is the source of both the Iraq and the Ukraine conflicts. Richard Black also pointed out that while most Americans do not want to be involved in the conflicts, the U.S. foreign policy establishment pursues its own separate agenda. Richard Black insisted that the U.S. overthrew Iraq with military force coming in from across the globe and has gone in and overthrown Ukraine with military force from the other side of the globe. The former state senator said The Ukraine conflict broke out when the CIA staged a violent, bloody coup d'etat in Kiev in 2014 and helped remove the legitimately elected president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, from power. Richard Black added, Washington replaced Viktor Yanukovych with a so-called revolutionary junta and began flooding Kiev with advanced weaponry with the aim of building up a very formidable military force. Richard Black clarified Ukraine's current president is nothing more than a puppet of Washington, who does what he's told and when he's told. According to the former senator, while most of the American population does not agree with the U.S. interventionist foreign policies, a group of so-called Washington elites, as well as oligarchs and the weapons manufacturing military-industrial complex, pursue their own interests, irrespective of others. Former Senator Richard Black further stated the conflict in Ukraine could be resolved if the country becomes neutral and demilitarized, similar to Austria during the Cold War period. The ex-state senator, Richard Black, emphasized that Russia's security concerns were justifiable and without a doubt needed to be taken into consideration by neighboring countries.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Be friends with the merciful God from your early childhood. This is a part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in Taklif celebration for a number of schoolgirls on the eve of the birth anniversary of Imam Ali alayhi salam, February 3rd, 2023. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. My dear children, first of all, the anthem you sang together was wonderful. Both the poem was good and its melody was good. And you sang it well. I congratulate you on this Taklif celebration. I also congratulate all of you, my dear daughters, on this Eid, the birth anniversary of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Peace be upon him. God willing, you will be successful. My dear daughters and dear young flowers, tonight we have prayed the obligatory prayers in congregation and this Husseiniya. May God accept your prayers, God willing. My dear children, the Taklif celebration is a real celebration. It is truly a celebration. It is truly an Eid. Why? Because from the moment you reach the age of being required to carry out your religious obligations, you talk with God and God talks with you. In other words, you are in a position where God will talk with you. He will entrust you with responsibilities and you will carry out those responsibilities.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
This is a valuable rank of human beings, that people are addressed by God and God talks with them. This is what the Taklif celebration means, that after this, you are not a child anymore. You are not a small child. You are now young girls with responsibilities, and you can have an influence on your family, in your school environment, and when you are playing with your friends. You can show others to the straight path and guide them, which is a responsibility that all of us have. A young girl like you, who has just reached the age of observing the religious obligations, is no different before the Almighty God than an adult woman or an elderly man in terms of their religious obligations. The advice I wish to give you young people, my advice to my dear daughters, is that you become friends with God. Try to become friends with the merciful God from the start of your youthhood. What is it like to be friends with God? One of the ways of becoming friends with God is when you are talking with God in prayers to pay attention to this, that you are talking with God. You are speaking with God.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Food tourism. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember in the previous episode, we briefly talked about a few foods in Golestan province and made you familiar with the simple recipe of these foods and sweets. In the fourth episode of this series, you will get familiar with another region of Golestan province, namely Kordkuy, and some of the foods and edibles of the region. Stay tuned, please. Kordkuy is located in the west of the northern province of Golestan. People in the region speak with Mazani dialect of Farsi language. This city is limited to massive forests on the south and the Caspian Sea on the north. The city is called Kordkuy, meaning region of Kurds, due to the migration of some Kurdish people from Uraman region in Kurdistan province in middle of 18th century. However, Kordkuy is home to several languages and dialects of various ethnicities which have migrated to the region. People of Kordkuy are very hospitable and sprightly. Among the most famous foods of the region, mention can be made of sag stew, pomegranate broth, nettle broth, stuffed kitchen and fish, and so on. Various sweets and cookies are also made in Kord Kuy, among which we can mention walnut halva, berenjak, that is, special cookies made of rice and sugar, shirnoon or milky bread, and others. Women in Kord Kuy usually prepare foods with local herbs. Some of these herbs are elzi or allium paradoxum, zolang or eryngium caucasicum, anorige, that is, fra repisop pita, oji or menta polygium, and gazane, that are lamium nettles. Kord Kuy is not far from the sea. Hence, seafood enjoys a special status in the cuisine of the region. Kipper is among the favorite fish of the people in Kord Kuy. This fish is very useful in reduction of blood pressure, betterment of eyes, skin, and mental health. It also helps reduce cholesterol and triglyceride in blood. Well, kipper is used to make a food in Kord Kuy called kapur kalle or head of kipper. This delicious food is usually served with soup or rice. To make this food, you will need kipper fish, garlic, parsley, onion, pomegranate paste, and spices. After a short break, you will hear the ingredients and recipe for two people. Popular food of Kord Kuy city in northern Iran, you need these ingredients for two people. 400 grams of kipper fish that are cut into narrow pieces with the head and tail. Half of a middle-sized onion chopped into narrow pieces and another half grated. 20 grams of chopped parsley. 2 spoonfuls of fried garlic. 10 grams of fried mint and a spoonful of pomegranate paste, salt, black pepper, turmeric and oil as much as needed. Now the recipe. Pour 3 glasses of water into a pot and put it on fire to boil. Add the chopped fish with salt, black pepper and grated onion and let it cook for 15 minutes. Take the fish out and remove the thorns from it. Then put it into the pot again. Pour parsley, hot mint, hot garlic, and pomegranate paste and let the kipper fish cook for another 15 minutes on a mild flame. Thus, your food is ready. We hope that you will make this food and enjoy it. Dear listeners, now let us get familiar with a kind of halva, which is quite popular in Golestan province and Kord Kuy city. It is called Jouze halva, that is, walnut halva. It requires a lot of patience to make this halva. Interestingly, many of the sweets and cookies of the northern Iran are made of rice. So, rice is used to make walnut halva too. The ingredients for 6 people: a glass of rice, a glass of sugar, a glass of ground walnut, 3 spoonfuls of oil, glass of water. And the recipe: first soak the rice in water for 3 to 4 hours. Then grind it. Now pour oil, in a copper or Teflon pot and pour the ground rice in it and let it cook mildly for nearly 5 minutes. Then add the chopped walnut and let it be on fire for around 10 minutes. In this phase, sugar and water are added and mixed completely. Increase the gas flame and stir the halva with a spoon for several 10 minutes. After 3 to 4 hours, it will become brownish. Now, it should be stirred continuously so that it becomes black. Once it is oily and does not stick to the pot, it is ready. Now, you should put out the oven and put a little oil on a tray and put the halva on it. Flatten the halva and cut it into pieces after cooling. Make it and enjoy it.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Years after Brexit, they're still talking about it. One big sticking point, the post-Brexit Northern Ireland Protocol for Trade, legislation that at one point threatened the Good Friday Peace Agreement and pushed the EU and UK to the brink of a trade war. Officials on both sides of the dispute now claim they have found a solution to the problem, and they have a name for it too.
The Windsor Framework delivers free-flowing trade within the whole United Kingdom. It protects Northern Ireland's place in our union, and it safeguards sovereignty for the people of Northern Ireland.
Under the new deal, there will be two routes for goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK. A green route with minimal checks for goods, which will stay in Northern Ireland, and a red one for goods which may continue into the EU after going through EU checks. Disputes will be settled by Northern Ireland courts, but some could still go to the European Court of Justice. And if new EU single market regulations are introduced, the UK government could veto them if the Northern Ireland Assembly has voted for that to happen.
We are now seeing part of the United Kingdom, namely the north of Ireland, essentially being re-invited back into aspects of the EU. And that is a very big statement. And I'm sure that Brussels is hoping this will begin to disintegrate the overall Brexit deal.
The details of the deal are yet to emerge, but Prime Minister Sunak faces two challenges. One is to get the approval of the Democratic Unionists in Northern Ireland, who have refused to enter a power-sharing government with Sinn Féin nationalists for months over the Boris Johnson-era protocol, which has created a sea border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK.
The unionists have a set of tests that have to be passed or they'll back out of it. Now, that's an insurance policy. They don't want to lose votes. They don't want to look like they've sold out the unionist agenda. And that makes political sense for them. The big test for Sunak, more than anything else, is whether he can get all sides to give a tick in the box.
In Westminster, meantime, the Prime Minister has briefed his cabinet, who seem to be on side.
The Prime Minister's next challenge would be winning the approval of the Eurosceptic Conservative members of the ERG, the European Research Group in the building behind me, who have already said that the revised bill does not go far enough, which means that the deal is not quite done yet. Saeed Poreza, London.
The indefinite strike, which began nationwide on January 4th in protest at the Dina Boluarte administration, remains strong in the southern regions of Peru, with major road closures in several provinces, according to the Ground Transport Authority. Nearly all of the civilians that have been reported killed since the December 7th ouster of President Castillo lost their lives in anti-government protests in this part of the country.
It's mainly the people in the countryside who are mistreated. We cry daily for our sons who have been killed, as many as 70 people by this government, and they still haven't acknowledged that they did it. They haven't said who was killed.
A newly released Ipsos poll finds that nationally, 51% of Peruvians believe that Pedro Castillo was ousted in a parliamentary coup, a number which surges to 69% in rural areas like here in the Puno region.
Particularly in Puno, they have marginalized us a lot. They have said that we are terrorists, that we are vandals, and that we are just Indians. We are going to continue fighting. I believe the strike will continue until Dina Boluarte resigns, as well as the rest of the Congress.
A preliminary report released this week by the International Human Rights and Solidarity Mission outlines numerous human rights abuses and calls for an investigation of the Peruvian state for crimes against humanity, for its excessive use of force against a defenseless civilian population and using lethal weapons.
I want justice to be served and for the whole world to find out everything that we are going through here. I want everyone to know so that there is justice for our children who have died.
Around the country, the popular call continues to be the demand for the resignation of Dina Boluarte, as well as immediate presidential elections. Camila Escalante, Desaguadero.
Consumer Association Federconsumatori has rung the alarm bell over the growing financial difficulties Italian families are faced with. Federconsumatori National Observatory has found that one out of four families in Italy is struggling to cope with high inflation and rising cost of living. This, as the Bureau of Statistics Istat has estimated, a timid comeback in consumer confidence in February. According to Federconsumatori, an increasing number of Italians are giving up on food quality to save money.
Today, as the cost of living crisis has eroded families' purchasing power, we have recorded a 17% drop in the purchase of meat and fish and a 13% drop in the consumption of fruit and vegetables. We had asked the government to introduce significant supporting measures for the Italian families, but unfortunately our calls went utterly unheard.
Prices in Italy rose more than 8% year on year in 2022, jumping to its highest 12-month gain in nearly 40 years when the lira currency was in use. According to Istat, Italy's annual inflation rate registered a slowdown in January, dropping to 10% from 11.6% in December. However, the situation has turned dire for many in the country.
The cost of living went up big way, too much for a young student like me. Prices have doubled over the past months.
The cost of staple food items, basic ingredients, has gone crazy, and also the cost of energy. To me, it's a theft by the government.
According to analysts, high energy prices have been the main drivers for the bulk of those increases, pushed higher by the energy supply challenges that followed the Ukraine-Russia war. The poverty rate increased significantly in Italy in 2020-2022 period. In 2021, some 2 million families lived in absolute poverty, a figure accounting for over 5.5 million people that is destined to grow. Max Civili, Rome.
Egypt's Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. In the meeting, the top diplomat conveyed Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's message of solidarity to Assad and all Syrians affected by the recent earthquakes. He also expressed Cairo's keenness on bolstering historic relations between Syria and Egypt, as well as boosting joint cooperation. Assad, for his part, thanked Egypt for sending humanitarian assistance, asserting that improving bilateral ties among Arab states constitute the foundation for improving the situation in general in the Arab world. Shoukry stressed that Egypt-Syria relations are a basic factor in the security of Arab countries. He also reiterated his country's support for Syria.
Egypt has offered so far 1,500 tons of assistance and will continue to provide all humanitarian assistance needed. Relations between both nations are strong. Egypt supports Syria in facing challenges. We hope Syria overcomes the repercussions of the earthquakes as soon as possible.
Shukri also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart, in which Faisal al-Maqdad briefed him on the steps taken by the Syrian government for helping Syrians affected by the earthquakes. Al-Maqdad also thanked Egypt for its unwavering aid to Syrians since day one of the earthquakes.
We welcome Egypt's foreign minister, who is visiting his home, people and country. His talks with President Assad focused on the results of the earthquakes and the historic relations between both countries. Egypt played a significant role in assisting Syrians following the earthquakes.
The visit comes a day after a historic trip by several senior lawmakers of Arab parliaments to Damascus, who affirmed they will push their governments for restoring relations with Syria. That's amid an increase in such moves by Arab states. This is the first visit for an Egyptian foreign minister to Syria since the start of the crisis in 2011. It's a clear indication of Egypt's serious intention to gradually restore normal ties with the Arab country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Tomatoes, one of your five a day. Supermarket giants in the UK are now only allowing three of these and other salad ingredients to their customers. And where there is availability, you'll have to pay a premium, especially when it comes to out-of-season fresh produce. Here is why.
Starting with climate change, 2022 was the second hottest year in Europe. Heat waves and extreme temperatures in Spain, one of Europe's biggest food producers, have meant fewer crops to harvest. The same problem with supplying countries such as Morocco in North Africa. But the UK has its own well-established food industry. One important component of it, greenhouses, many hectares of which now lay barren.
There is a problem, of course, with the high price of gas that is used to heat up these greenhouses. They do require quite a lot of gas input, and that's quite expensive. And the problem is that the supermarkets are also being very tough on pricing. So it's not easy to then raise your prices and get what you want from the supermarkets. And so rather than produce anything at a loss, some producers have obviously decided not to produce at all.
And the UK faces another particular issue. Most of its fruit and veg come from the European Union. The country's exit from the bloc has meant extra costs and bureaucracy added to the strain, especially on the supply of perishable goods.
Brexit has caused a shortage of labour, and a shortage of labour means a shortage of fruit and vegetables at the end of the day. More bureaucracy, and more bureaucracy means more costs, and more costs mean less profits, and therefore lower UK production. It's as simple as that.
The solution, food-producing organisations say, is for the government to provide more support, such as replacing high-carbon fertilizers with low-carbon alternatives, or investing more in soil-free indoor growing techniques, such as vertical farming. Saeed Purza, London.
The first memorial of martyrs of resistance media, entitled Narrators of Resistance, has been held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. The families of media martyrs from Iran, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, Palestine, and Lebanon attended the event. Addressing the ceremony, the commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Quds Force, Brigadier General Ismail Ghani, praised the martyrs of resistance media as a treasure which must be well invested.
The media presence of our martyrs makes them convey the sublime values that led them to achieve the goal of martyrdom. The global arrogance led by the U.S. promotes that those who own money and the biggest weapons are to emerge victorious in wars. However, despite its limited capabilities, the media of the resistance front succeeded in conveying the voice of truth.
Moreover, speaking at the event, head of the IRIB, Dr. Jebeli, honored the media martyrs on the resistance front.
In hard war, the enemy seeks to destroy our fortifications and force us to retreat from one place to another. But in soft war, the enemy does not use weapons, bombardment, and physically does not seek to push us back from one area to another, but seeks to mislead us, change our thinking, distort reality, and take us away from the straight path. We proudly pay for our resistance, but I would like to say that resistance not only costs nothing, but is a total investment. The participants believe that along with the war launched against the axis of resistance in the military sphere, the U.S. and the Zionist regime have also been using all means in the media sphere to undermine the resistance.
The participants believe that along with the war launched against the axis of resistance in the military sphere, the U.S. and the Zionist regime have also been using all means in the media sphere to undermine the resistance.
Journalists of resistance.